Hello, and welcome to our first in a series of food waste webinars brought to you by the U.S. EPA Environmental Protection Agency Region 2 and the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation in partnership with the Solid Waste Resource Renewal Group at Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experimental Station. I'm Gary Fineland with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, and I will be introducing the webinars and speakers. The webinar series is designed to provide tips and tools for food waste generators. We are happy to have you participating with us today. Our five-part series will include topics such as an introduction to food waste and the climate change connection, how to conduct a waste audit, separation and collection of food waste, food donation, composting, and anaerobic digestion, and EPA's tools for waste reduction and food waste management. We look forward to your participation in this webinar series. The goal of today's webinar is to provide an informational overview of food waste, including why food waste management is an issue, the food waste climate connection, and the EPA waste reduction model, AKA WARM. In addition, we'll discuss how to use a waste audit as a tool to help reduce and better manage food waste. Before I introduce today's speakers, I'll turn the line over to Amy Wolfram, who will go over some of the call logistics. Amy?
Thanks, Gary. Hello, everyone, and thanks for coming to the webinar today. My name is Amy Wolfram, and I work for ICF International, which is a contractor for the U.S. EPA. I wanted to go over some logistics with you. First off, this is a recorded session, so you all know. If you have any problems connecting to the webinar or seeing the slides, please email Shauna Baswani, and her email address is S as in Sam, V as in Victor, A, S, W, A, N as in Nancy, I, at ICFI.com. The slides in the presentation that you'll see today, the two presentations will be moved for you, so you don't need to worry about advancing them yourself, and there may be up to a 10-second delay. If you're listening through your computer speakers and you hear an echo during the webinar, go ahead and turn down your computer volume. In order to listen using the phone line, you must dial into the phone number and enter the participant code that was assigned to you when you registered for the webinar. Also note that there will be a several second delay as we transition between speakers and respond to questions. So please be patient during these transition times for us. Also, we encourage questions during the webinars, but we ask you make note of them and wait until the end of the presentations and hold them until the Q&A session. This is because the presentations are being recorded, and it's best if all the questions are asked verbally, and we can also condense questions and answer them. So those are some of the call logistics, and I'd like to turn it back over to Gary. Gary, are you there?
Thanks, Amy. It helps to unmute the phone. Today we have two great speakers lined up. Priscilla Hayes Esquire of Rutgers, New Jersey Agricultural Experiment Station, and Jennifer Brady of U.S. EPA Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. The conclusion of today's presentations will provide an opportunity for participants to ask questions, as Amy has stated. Again, thanks for participating, and we'll get started. I'll introduce our first speaker. Priscilla Hayes is the Executive Director of the Solid Waste Resource Renewal Group, SWRRG, which works primarily to promote conversion of the resources found in solid waste into innovative new products. Since its earliest days, the SWRRG has been working to create systems and facilities which can convert New Jersey's food waste and other organic waste into vehicle fuel, other energy sources, and high-quality soil amendments. Ms. Hayes has become one of New Jersey's primary experts on food and organics recycling in New Jersey and has authored numerous studies that will help enable people to reclaim value from food waste and other organics. Priscilla?
Hi, this is Priscilla Hayes. The food waste has been one of our issues that we've been on for more than a decade. And what we are doing is bringing together all the elements of a local industry in New Jersey. And especially we feel that what we do in New Jersey is a model for the country. We have our little motto is, as New Jersey goes, so goes the country. So thing that you will agree. All right, so first slide, which will come up in a minute, is food waste characteristics. And food waste has some characteristics that make it unique among the aspects of solid waste. It may weigh up 900 pounds per cubic yard. It averages about 75% water, but it could be up to 90% water. It contributes to greenhouse gas production in landfills. We'll talk about that a little bit more later. And it burns inefficiently in an incinerator because if you burn water, that's not very efficient. And according to USDA, their most recent figures, which are a few years old, but anyway, they characterize it as 10.1% of the roughly 217 million tons of solid waste nationwide. And they show that only 2.6% of that amount is recycled. High food waste management is an issue. Food waste management is an issue because it's really the, not only because of the characteristics that make it different from other kinds of waste, but because it's a solution to so many problems. And the first one is, I'm all finished, don't look in the garbage. This comes from when I was young, my brother was left in the dining room to finish his dinner, and eventually he came out and said to my mother, I'm all finished, Mom, but don't look in the garbage. And of course, garbage too. There are a group of, many of you probably know of them, of garbologists who have been digging up our landfills for a long time. They originated with the studies at the University of Arizona. And the carrots that you saw in the previous slide are actual carrots that were dug up a decade or more after they were put into the landfill. So what happens is that we end up losing the resources, or many of the resources we simply lose by putting them in landfills because they just sit there. On the other hand, there is some decomposition based on the conditions in the landfill, more or less, and that is all anaerobic decomposition and is a major producer of methane, which is a gas with 22 times the warming capacity of carbon dioxide. And you'll hear a little bit later about the warm model, and it's based on a lower figure. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has two figures. I'll talk a little bit more about the 72 times figure in a few minutes. That was problem number one. Problem number two, going on to that, is the methane emissions from landfills. Even the best landfills in our state, and New Jersey does have some of the state-of-the-art landfills, can only collect some of the methane gas that is generated by degrading food. Landfills in this country are the primary source of methane emissions in the U.S. Across the world, there are other things that are larger sources, such as rice paddies and animal farming. But in the U.S., it's landfills in most areas of the U.S. The newest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports indicate that methane has a global warming potential 72 times that of carbon dioxide. All of this together adds up to being a problem. Solution, again, is food waste. And I have two duplicative slides here. Okay, solution, food waste. Methane, landfills don't have to emit methane. If we keep food waste and other organics out of landfills, we can stop at least the production of new methane. We are going to have residual methane being produced by the organics that are already there. Methane has a very short lifetime, though, only 12 years. And in 12 years, if we stop sending the food waste to landfills, we could significantly reduce the amount of methane in our atmosphere, because the methane that came out is to have been found by then. All right. Next problem is...
Actually, Priscilla, this is Amy Wolfram. Let me interrupt you for one brief second. For those of you who are asking questions about not being able to dial into the webinar, could you please try the link again and the phone number again to make sure that you're dialing in using the correct participant code, just to make sure you're not accidentally trying to call into a different meeting. We have the availability, we believe, for many more lines of people to call in. So if you wouldn't mind trying again, that would be great. Priscilla, I'm sorry to have interrupted you. Thank you.
Shall I go on, or?
Or actually, that's a good point. If they probably can't hear my message, we'll post an answer on the question. We'll post the answer on the QA panel. Thank you. Sorry, Priscilla. Please go ahead.
Okay. Now, another problem that to which food waste is the answer is New Jersey's lagging recycling rate. And again, as I said before, as New Jersey goes, so goes the world. We were the first ones one of the first states to start recycling. We have lagged behind some other states, but there is a lagging recycling rate in many parts of the country. And in New Jersey, after more than 20 years, we're still recycling. These figures are a couple years old, but I'm not sure we've gotten any better. 35.9% of our MSW, which is, of course, the waste that includes the bulky and the construction waste, our goal for that was 50%. Even if we add in the other stuff, we still don't meet a goal. We had a total goal for recycling of 60%, and we're still only at 54.6%. And as I indicated, again, one of the solutions is food, or a large solution is food waste recycling. The New Jersey DEP tonnage estimates are based on an interpretation of EPA ones, but either way, the food waste category comes out to be an estimated 15% of all MSW. We have another interesting category called other paper, which is an organic category, which is not a recycled kind of paper, which is also 18%. Recycling both of these would definitely put us over the 50% rate, but I believe that just recycling the food waste and some of the other organic waste, like grass clippings and things like that, which are not well recycled, would definitely put us over at least 50%. The New York City Department of Sanitation did a study a couple of years ago showing that, especially now that there's less glass in the bottles and cans stream, that even if you recycled every scrap of recyclable paper and every recyclable bottle or can, you could only achieve 36% recycling rate. They found food waste to be a larger amount of the entire waste segment, and 18% of the entire waste segment, and the largest single segment, and that would put us over 50%. Interestingly enough, in New York City, I looked for that category of other paper, and I couldn't find it, actually. So will be interesting, something I've been working on, trying to figure out how much non-recyclable paper there is out there and what can be done with it. One that we've been using for some time, on the quantities of food waste that various types of institutions generate and why it's such a fruitful recycling area. These figures were developed by John Metzger of EnviroFeed of New Jersey, which was a facility which was recycling food waste into animal feed, pelletized animal feed, for a short period of time. Unfortunately, we lost the facility due to a perception that the food waste might be able to transmit mad cow, but it was, and for some other economic reasons. But the figures are the best that we, among the best that we have. And you see that supermarkets in particular, when you do a waste audit of supermarkets, you'll find that most of the waste is actual food waste, and that's why it's such a fruitful area for most of these institutions to take out of your waste stream and raise your recycling rate and lower your trash bill. All right, these are our own waste audits that we did. In Princeton at a restaurant, Terra Momo, or Mediterra rather, we found that about 6/10 of a pound per person per meal ends up as food waste. And in, if you took all of the kitchen waste, 22% was food waste, 23% was cardboard, and 46% was glass bottles and cans. They had a bar here, so of course that makes weight of the bottles and cans larger than it might be at some other places like a supermarket because there's a preponderance of glass. Anyway, if you recycle just those three categories, attain, or food waste, cardboard, and cans and bottles, you could attain a 91% recycling rate for that restaurant. They had some other small amounts of paper and plastic recycled film, and again, even those might be able to be recycled. Especially this is in the Princeton Borough where they've started a drop-off site for that. I did a sampling of some other restaurant figures. Los Angeles actually found that 75% to 80% of a restaurant's waste was food waste. That's somewhat higher than what we found in Princeton. Mohegan Sun, which is a casino and has both the hotel and the casino, found that 14% of its total waste was food waste. And Mohegan Sun actually finds it very financially responsible or whatever to recycle their food waste. They have been recycling their food waste I think about a decade with a local pig farmer, even though it's 14% of their waste stream. Overall, for restaurants especially, food waste offers the opportunity to send the heaviest and the wettest and the most odorous parts of the waste stream to options that will be cheaper than disposal, to which food waste is an answer. Increasing costs of oil and other fossil fuels are driving prices up. Oil and natural gas are used to make, oil is used to make vehicle fuel, and natural gas is used for heating homes and for making fertilizers, and the prices are going to keep going up. Actually, nitrogen inputs from natural gas and oil are the largest contributors to the energy usage and greenhouse gas production from many agricultural products, especially meat. All of these, this is going to mean that these prices are going to keep going up. There is concern that people will go hungry, and I think that's partly, of course, because we're not distributing resources well, but it's also because we're substituting some agricultural things for some fuel things. Solution, food waste recycling. New Jersey, some of the facilities that we're looking at in New Jersey and across the region are facilities which will manufacture fuel for vehicles or for power. And we already have one facility in New Jersey which is manufacturing fertilizers. We're looking at, of course, at compost facilities which manufacture other soil products. The fertilizers and the soil amendments which come from food waste tend to make the soil function better than simply throwing more chemical fertilizer at it. Also, in New Jersey, we've used the compost to do things like retrofit detention basins so that we recharge rather than running, having pollution run off into Barnegat Bay and things like that. Anyway, these products are not going to be dependent on the rising prices of fossil fuels. And we are finding that organic farmers especially use these products for production of food locally. We have an organization in New Jersey, which is called Farmers Against Hunger, which makes sure that some of the food that's produced and is excess here is distributed there better. New York State also has, the last bullet, farms are also an area where food waste and organic waste can be transformed into energy and soil-enriching products. And New York State especially is one of the locations where there has been both anaerobic digestion on farms and also composting on farms. The last problem, although I have other things to say also, the last problem is the loss of jobs and local manufacturing to other places. Things that were once manufactured in New Jersey and the region are being made abroad or in other areas of the country where labor and other costs are cheaper, and we're losing jobs. And again, a solution, food waste recycling. The reason why we are concentrating on this industry is because recycling facilities can bring in local capital which can circulate in our new local economy. They also allow us to have our own local feedstock, which is food waste, made into something that we are going to actually be able to transport and use right within our own area. Recycling facilities are going to bring new green jobs at all levels of skill and income. And one of the things that we are working towards is a green jobs program that would look at training people to do more of the waste audit kinds of jobs that we're going to talk about at the end of this webinar, and also a new idea of doing waste shed audits, which is creating waste sheds, which I'll talk about in a few minutes. All right, so those were, I'm going to talk, now that I've gone through how the food waste is the solution to every problem, I'll go on to a couple of additional benefits and possibilities. Food waste offers a lower cost for handling the heaviest and the wettest waste. Talked about that a little. That we're looking at, some of the people who are trying to invest in our food waste recycling operations are especially looking at is the opportunity for municipal governments and other governments to get involved in this, or even companies to get involved in this by sending their food waste or promoting a food waste recycling facility and then being able to buy back the product that is made by it. And the Hyatt Regency in Princeton has actually been trying to buy back the fertilizer from Converted Organics, which is the facility to which it sends its waste. We're talking about trying to do a similar model with Trenton and perhaps use some fuel that we could manufacture there at a plant we're trying to get established there for Trenton vehicles. One of the early things that happened with all of our food waste recycling systems is that, Mike Manahu and John Metzger, who I talked about before, are two of early experts who worked on creating containers and creating systems that are going to minimize the risk of employee injury by not having people actually have to lift this, using wheeled carts and other things that minimize testing. You'll probably hear about more later in future webinars. And again, another thing, this is related to the buyback thing. The food waste recycling offers the opportunity to work with a range of partners to take advantage of the cost benefits, or if you're a municipality, to encourage your restaurants to do that, and to be in control. I mean, we're thinking that, you know, some of the locations in the state which have gone into banning organics from the landfill, it offers generators the opportunity to stay ahead of potential bans or mandates or whatever, and be ahead of the curve. This is a lot of words, and I'm not going to go into all of it, but the New Jersey Board of Public Utilities had Rutgers University do a biomass study. We were using the existing sources of data, which have a lot of problems, but they're using the existing sources of data to quantify, to do an initial quantification of how much biomass there was available in the state of New Jersey to make into fuel and energy products. And as you can see in the last bullet, the estimates show that we could produce perhaps 9% of our electricity consumption or 5% of our transportation fuels. I had some problems with how conservatively some of the estimates of what we could capture were, so I think that the numbers are actually higher. The other thing is this data reflects, I think, a lower amount of food waste than we would actually show if we could do some more research beyond the existing figures, which are all based on estimates. I'm going to switch for a minute now. Now we've talked about why food management is an issue, and I'm going to go to the what. I talked a few minutes ago. These are the available outlets for non-residential food waste recycling in New Jersey and New York. The first one, obviously, is source reduction, reducing portion sizes and less waste at the source. That has happened, I think, some in restaurants just because of the economic situation, but it is a bit slow to happen. Human use. In New Jersey, we have a fairly well-developed set of food banks, and I hope that other states shared with us recently, they all got an infusion of cash, which allowed them to beef up their freezers and all sorts of other kinds of storage so that they could accept more food waste and feed hungry people. Animal use has somewhat limited. I know in we did a national study of food waste recycling across the country, and only about half of the states at that time allowed you to actually feed food waste to animals. I think that has actually declined somewhat more, and as I mentioned before, we lost our pelletization plant in part because of the low amount that corn was selling for, and the perception that mad cow might be transmitted by it. Now, I talked about how more corn is being used for ethanol, so we actually sort of applauded that and said, well, maybe that'll make food waste more acceptable as an animal feed, but this isn't one that I necessarily expect to be a huge player. It's going to get smaller. Composting is another option. In New Jersey, we're not probably going to ever have any more outdoor uncovered compost facilities, but we've seen a very nice development in a great covered windrow facility in northern New Jersey and some in-vessel composting facilities. We have one at Kane University that's an in-vessel system that's been developed especially for universities and schools. Fuel components, we're looking at anaerobic digesters to make natural gas for trucks or for electricity production. and we're looking at a plant in New Jersey which would create biodiesel. And we're looking at other developing technologies too. And the final part of this, which is a few slides, is going to be if, as the science is generators, food waste generators, how would you pick an option? What would you think about in picking an option? And I've borrowed from the, you'll see in the next slide, from the five steps that we've created for food and organics recycling for New York and New Jersey. It's a an organization, a membership organization, which has basically just a Google website and a discussion group. And we've had one generator certified. But anyway, I borrowed from those steps that we developed for that. It's intuitive that if you can use the closest place that recycles food waste, that's going to reduce your hauling charges. The other thing that we found early on is that some places like Whole Foods require the ability to be able to get rid of waxy cardboard and some other things along with their food waste. So you need to do a waste audit, see what you have, what you want to get rid of, and go from there. The five steps, the generators, again, these, I don't have the four New Jersey website on here, but at the end there's my contact information, so please email me or Gary, actually, to about the Four New Jersey program. The five steps that generators should go through to figure out how to recycle their food waste are the waste audit, which is that audit, which I'm going to talk about briefly, purchasing audit, sustainability calculations, and that's largely the WARM model, which you're going to hear about from Jennifer, and then just doing some planning for when you have a food waste recycling option actually near you. All right, waste audit, and we'll go into this later, involves quantifying your waste and figuring out what you have in what quantities, and then comparing that against what you're paying now and figuring out how you can best recycle the large quantities of things that you have. So if you're a supermarket, you're going to find that most of your waste is food waste. And if you come up with a way to recycle that, you're going to save a lot of money. The thing is that a waste audit always leads to you looking at your system and reconfiguring your bins at the back. You can't just add a new system. You need to move around, change around all your other bins. You need to reduce the size of your trash bin. You need to figure out how you're going to collect all your different materials. You can't just add something. You have to revamp the whole system. A waste shed is essentially just a compact, dense route. This is something that we're all very familiar with in the residential arena. You know, in your neighborhood, in most neighborhoods anyway, in Princeton or a few places it's a little bit different if you have subscriptions, but in most neighborhoods the same truck goes from house to house. You don't have three trucks going through the same neighborhood sort of cherry picking the houses. On the commercial side, however, we've been doing a waste shed audit in Newark, and we're finding that there may be 10 trucks or more than that going down each street. And they're picking up, they're not picking up food waste per se right now, but they're picking up trash or they're picking up bottles and cans. And you've got 10 trucks going down the same street belching out diesel pollution. With food waste, we realized early on, given that we have limited facilities and we're going to have to drive somewhat far, especially to start with, that wasn't going to work. We needed to have concentrated routes. And so in Newark, we're looking at creating a concentrated, dense route of restaurants who would all band together and use one truck to haul their food waste to one facility. So that's what a waste shed is. The other way of creating a waste, or another way of creating a waste shed, is to, in a small area, like Northampton, Massachusetts, what they've done is they've taken some common land and they've created sheds where they collect all of the similar kinds of things from a variety of restaurants or stores. So they have one shed and they collect all the food waste, all the bottles and cans, and all of the other things. They did actually have food waste for a while as one of the materials. I'm not sure. They may have lost some of the markets for that, but actually I think the system was originally built around food waste and being able to get that out of there. The smallest waste sheds actually are do-it-yourself kinds of waste sheds. On the left you see the in-vessel composter, which was developed at Montclair State University. This particular one is not currently in use because the person who has his back to the camera in the white coat and the white hair, Nick Smith-Sebasto, has moved to Kane University. And now what he's doing is collecting food waste from all of the university dining facilities and getting it to a bigger, better in-vessel composter and making compost for the campus. On the right, there's a composter that is hand-driven, obviously, and is able to handle its own food waste. Either way, this. And we consider this sort of the smallest waste shed, a waste shed of one. This Northampton shed that I talked about, their shed system, probably aren't much pictures, but anyway, you can see in there's a variety of different small bins in there, and each one is assigned to a different material. And they serve that cornucopia restaurant that you can see on the right side and a variety of other stores. So you can put all your waste together, aggregate it, and have the hauler come only to one place. This is the residential map, but it shows what we're all familiar with on the residential side. You know, this is a town in Burlington County. They've created three residential districts. They constitute waste sheds. You know, each one of those districts is enough to fill up one truck on whatever material this is. And that's something that we're looking at in the area of food waste. It just has not been used on the commercial side the way that it could be. Obviously, in some places it's been used, well, bids and various things in order to create this. Webinar has ended. These are just bigger maps to show, you know, that it can be of varying sizes. This is Essex County. That's where Newark is. You can see Newark over at the right. Newark on the left as part of Essex County, and on the right you can see the Ironbound neighborhood where we're working. We're confident that in that neighborhood, we should have enough food waste to fill several trucks. All right. Audit. The purchasing audit is another way of saying you have to figure out whether you're going to need compostable items to bolster your food waste recycling program. In most instances, you're going to need at least compostable liners. Plastic is one of the biggest contamination factors at most food waste facilities, and you don't want to send it. Compostable tableware is only useful if you're actually going to be sending it to a food waste facility. I know places like Princeton University and other places have things like when they have their reunions, they have compostable cups and they're ending up in the landfill and nothing's happening with them. So a purchasing audit basically is to look at what are you purchasing, what do you have to replace to make your food waste recycling successful, but not, you know, overdoing it so that you replace.
I'm sorry to interrupt you again, Priscilla. This is Amy Wolfram. I just wanted to make sure all the presenters are, is that background noise coming from where you're
I have no idea where, I mean, it sounds like we're in an industrial facility.
Right, I agree, and I apologize for that. Could all the presenters make sure that their phones are on mute so that we don't hear that noise? Sorry about this, everyone. So I still hear some background noise, but hopefully that'll... go ahead, Priscilla.
I'm on the last couple ones. Sustainability calculations and PR. And the idea, I mean, Jennifer's going to go into the one model in the next segment. Essentially, what I'm trying to say here is that, we've already talked about food waste recycling, preventing methane production. So the WARM model will give you a way of quantifying that. By joining WasteWise, which you can actually even do more than just plain using the WARM model, that will give you free PR materials, and it will do your calculations for you and help you publicize your sustainability. It's something that we've been pushing all along, because what could be better than doing your calculations free and helping you with these publicity materials? And the final step is planning for your options to arrive. And the notion here is that we may not have the food waste recycling facilities in every location. They may not be close enough to you. In the state of Ohio, one of the Whole Foods was so anxious to get on board with food waste recycling that they sent their food waste, over 100 miles at larger cost than trash to make sure they could start recycling. But in most instances, what you want to do is make sure you start researching what food waste recycling options are available. Get a waste audit. Figure out what you can do, what you could do to separate the food waste, how you could reduce change your other bins over so that you would get the benefit of the reduced cost on the food waste, and just basically get ready. In New York City, at least, Action Carting is already taking food waste to various facilities. Converted Organics has opened in New Jersey. We have three haulers in New Jersey that are doing a lot of food waste recycling, and I get calls from new ones every day. So this planning stage may not be long. You may be ready to get your food waste hauled away very quickly. And the last slide except for my contact information is just from Frances Moore LaPay. She has a new book out that I highly recommend. But this one is from Democracy's Edge, and she basically is just restating that everything that we do and we don't do matters, and that it's very important to do this for other reasons than economic reasons. She also says that the same part of your brain lights up for chocolate and for doing things that bring you into better cooperation with each other and help each other. So, and this is my contact information. And Amy or whoever, I'll turn it back over to you.
This is Gary Filan. Thank you, Priscilla, for a great presentation. I just wanted to remind folks that we have a question and answer feature to our webinar, but we ask you to make notes of your questions throughout the presentations and hold them until the question and answer session at the end of the presentation. Reason for that is because we'd like to, Amy Wolfram, who's facilitating, will summarize all those questions and then ask them to the presenters at the end of after the last presentation. Amy, did you want to add anything?
Just that if you're looking for the question and answer feature, it's up at the top of your screen in the menu. So But that's all I'd like to have for now. We can go over it later.
Thank you. Thanks, Amy. Our next speaker is Jennifer Brady. She works in US EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. Some of us knew it from its other name as the Office of Solid Waste. Jennifer specializes in the measurement of waste generation and waste management. A large part of her work focuses on the estimation of greenhouse gas and energy benefits from recycling and composting. She also spends time helping states, localities, and businesses properly use the waste reduction model. Jennifer?
Thanks, Gary. First of all, if it's not already a little obvious, I have to apologize for my voice. It's kind of cutting in and out on me. I've been suffering from a little laryngitis, post-cold laryngitis, for the past few days. I will try to be as clear as possible throughout, but I may take a couple breaks to clear my throat and take a little sip of water. So my apologies from the beginning. I'm going to talk about the more, I guess, quantifiable side of food waste management and directly how we are linking it to climate change currently. So, again, I may be a little brief today just because I don't have much breath left, but hopefully I can convey at least the basic points, and feel free to contact me and we can follow up in the future. So let me see if I can get this to go. Okay. So calculating GHGs, rich greenhouse gases from waste, first of all, not just in the food sector, but in all sectors, is sometimes a difficult endeavor because waste is not a single point source of emissions. There's many points along the line where we can say waste causes emissions, and it can be as direct as something like the landfill, which we think of as the waste part of it, but it can also be in the future production of goods, which may be reduced or altered if we go through practices like recycling and composting. And so when we're thinking about the greenhouse gases from waste, we have to think about all those points and what the potential greenhouse gas implications are. We talk about this as the life cycle. So emissions occur across the entire life cycle of a material. Just kind of as an aside, for those of you who are really interested in the climate discussion, in climate inventory terms, these are often referred to as scope 3 emissions. And a lot of times, though we're trying to work hard to bring them into the discussion, a lot of times these are an aside when you're doing inventories and counting your emissions. It's usually the first one is your point source, your kind of smokestacks. Your second ones are your indirect, say from the electricity produced to run your operations. And then the scope 3 kind of encompasses a lot of different emissions, among those the waste emissions. But again, I think there's a lot of discussion going on and how we can recognize that these are an important source of emissions, and it is an important place where emissions can be reduced. What we do here at EPA is we've created a model that looks at what we're going to call a streamlined life cycle methodology. It's streamlined because it doesn't include every stage of the life cycle. Most noticeably, we don't include the use stage, and that's basically because we've determined that it's a bit of a wash. The best example I have is a soda can. If you use a recycled soda can, it's going to take the same energy, actually you using it, so that means drinking the soda, as if you used a 100% virgin soda can. So there's really no difference in emissions at the use phase. So that is included. Also, it's streamlined because our life cycle only looks at the benefits and costs of greenhouse gas emissions and energy. A more comprehensive life cycle is going to look at toxic effects, it's going to look at water quality effects. A life cycle can look at a whole broad range of environmental impacts. But our model right now looks exclusively at the greenhouse gas impacts or the BTU impacts. which are the energy impacts. The focus in which you'll find the emissions coming from along the life cycle are from GHGs emitted. A direct emission would be from the landfill, and I think Priscilla mentioned that. Carbon storage, which is a bit of a more complex topic, which I'll talk a little bit about. Or utility energy displaced, and that could happen in most directly you would think about waste to energy, but also in landfill gas capture. And just to be a little more explicit about some of these stages, there's raw material acquisition. So if we have a product available for future production, so if we have some scrap metal available, or we have food waste available for compost production, we don't need to go and acquire those raw materials that we would normally need. Manufacturing of the product, oftentimes the recycled, quote-unquote recycled, and we, when we say recycled, we also a lot of times include composting in that, product takes less energy to produce than the product would from virgin materials. Waste management downstream, which is basically in the landfill, but also some additional cost of transporting materials and then maintaining materials, maintaining the landfill. And then transportation of raw material and waste, so transportation along many different points. So when we're looking at the life cycle and all the impacts of waste management, we're looking at all these stages and how our waste management practices can affect all these different stages. And most of these are relevant for the food waste management also. What are the GHG savings? And I tried to focus in here on food waste. Most of the emission savings for food waste right now are from avoided landfill emissions, because even though we are only, we're using, and I guess I should discuss this as an aside, Priscilla mentioned the use of the 72 as the global warming potential. Currently, we are not using the 72. I think we're using the 23. And that is because that's what currently EPA and our Office of Air uses when they report the national inventory to IPCC. So we're on their schedule in a way. If the Office of Air decided, because IPCC told them or instructed them, when they report their inventory to report with the 72 times, we would then change WARM to reflect that 72 times. So basically, as in a lot of other parts of our model, we're not really the primary owners of the data and the information, and we're following others' leads, and so we're still using the reporting system that our Office of Air is using. But if it does come to be a time where it goes to the 72, the WARM will reflect that. a little extra here, and it's not something you'll see in the model yet, but we've been very actively looking at the impacts of food waste management in general and how these should be reflected in the WARM model. And we've been looking at very much over the past year. So what we are expecting in the next 6 months or so, hopefully, is that that portion of the model is going to change pretty drastically. And what I can do now, at least, we don't have examples of it, but give you some indications of how that's going to change. And one big thing is we're going to have new assumptions about how landfill and methanes capture gas in the landfill. And part of that is going to be based on, currently we have it based on a average capture rate efficiency over the lifetime of the landfill. So you could plug in any value from 0 to 100 to say what you think the capture rate is. We are going to have a weighted average in the future such that we'll recognize that even a landfill that gets up to a 99% efficiency will probably for several years be at 0%, 5%, 10%, then before it gets to that 90%. And so the new assumptions are going to be based on a more graduated lifetime capture rate rather than one lifetime capture rate. And hopefully, as I said, you'll be seeing these changes in probably early summer or so, and we'll be talking about them in more detail throughout the spring as we have some of our technical experts comment and tell us how they feel about what they've seen. So hopefully this will more accurately reflect how much methane is being captured, particularly with the very putrescible materials like food waste. We're also going to combine this with the decay rates, which recognize the fact that some material is going to decay faster in the landfill, or even before it gets to landfill, possibly, than other materials. So what this means, in a really simplistic one-on-one terms, are if the material decays very quickly, it's more likely to get caught in those early years when the capture rate isn't as high. And so the methane released is going to be higher than it would be if it decayed more slowly and maybe fell under the higher capture rate when the cap was in place and when the full capture system was in. So I'm sorry to kind of gloss over that, but we're still working on it, and I'm more than happy to talk to people if they're really interested in that particular part of the model. We're still getting technical comment to see if people agree with it. We're talking with our other offices here at EPA who work in this area, like our Office of Air Quality, our Landfill Methane Outreach Program, to see if they also agree with some of these new assumptions we'd like to make. Another assumption and emission savings in the model for carbon storage in soils. And this is another area where we really feel like the research is emerging and we're trying to follow it as closely as possible and trying to really put the newest and best information into WARM. And we're looking a lot at Dr. Holly Brown's work that she's been doing on the West Coast as to how the carbon storage increases in soils that have been supplemented with compost. And basically what this is going to do is it's going to give additional carbon credits or kind of debits in a way for composting, because what we're saying is more carbon will be stored rather than being released into the environment as it would be if a compost wasn't applied. So again, this is somewhere we're looking into the new research. Hopefully in the next 6 months or so, it'll be reflected in the model. And the combination of these two things, so they're kind of crammed onto one slide here, and it may seem, you know, pretty basic, could have some fairly significant impacts, particularly on food waste, because food waste does degrade so quickly, as opposed to something like branches, which are going to degrade really slowly and may not be as affected by these changes. But food waste is really the category that's going to be most affected by some of these changes we're looking at for the model. So that's kind of a preview to come. Okay, now kind of a little more direct about the emissions. There are some GHG emissions from composting. Transportation of the materials, you still have to move the materials because we are modeling industrial commercial size operations. We're not modeling backyard composting, which is obviously a great thing to do, and it would cut out all these if you were doing that. But we are modeling larger quantities and larger facilities. We do assume they are aerated windrow piles, and we do assume there's a mechanical turning of the compost piles, and so there's a bit of emissions from that, from the emissions from the vehicles that turn the piles. This is another area where we try to keep up. I know BioCycle did a big report last year on what the predominant compost technologies are out there right now, and if we find that windrow piles and this sort of functioning of compost doesn't end up being the dominant technology, we'll move to the new technology. And who knows, 10 years from now, it could be anaerobic digestion or some other technology. But right now, we still find that the windrow piles are the predominant composting operation to model. And so that's why we use that. Our results have showed, and I think this might change a little, we're still looking at this again, this is in our studies, that the methane from compost piles are essentially zero, and the carbon dioxide. But we're still looking at this, and I think this is another area where the research is really evolving. And that's kind of an exciting thing about the whole food waste management and climate connection.
All participants have been muted.
People are really taking a lot of time to look at it now, and we're getting a lot of new research every day on the climate connection with food waste, and hopefully we are trying our best to keep up with all of this and incorporate it into the model so we can have the best results possible. GHG savings from compost, so this is emission savings. I mentioned briefly carbon storage from depleted soils. Currently, we're modeling this using something called a Century Model, which is out of the Forest Service, the USDA. But it looks like in the future, we may actually be able to use field tests and field studies to have our results for this, which I think is going to be even better and even more accurate than modeling it when we have real live on the ground results. A result that a lot of people don't like, but it is unfortunately kind of part of the, I shouldn't say unfortunately, well, it is part of the accounting system, is the biogenic emissions from landfills are not included because we assume that those would have occurred anyway. Basically, if the scrap of paper or the carrot would have been left on the ground and it would have eroded, it would have degraded just on the side of the road, it would have emitted CO2. So that's not included in the inventory, and it's referred to as a biogenic emission, whereas if it's converted to methane, it is included because that would be an anthropogenic emission. In the same breath, I should say, and I have it included here, we do have carbon storage in landfills because, as Priscilla showed, some material never degrades in a landfill, and in the world of inventories, that's actually counted as a carbon sink because it's storing carbon that will never be released back into the atmosphere. Again, this is kind of a function of the inventory process and how the inventory rules are currently structured, and we follow those when we set up the rules for the model. So I started to go into this landfill carbon storage. Some materials are not completely decomposed in the landfill, and so they're stored. This counts as a sink and actually gives some credit to the landfill. This is not as much of an issue for food scraps because they do degrade rather fully in the landfill or not in the landfill, but it's a problem for some of the other organic materials, and in particular some of the organic materials that may be included in a compost combination, some of the wood chips and things like that, so some of the things you would combine with the food scraps in a compost operation. Just as kind of a range here, even if the unit metric tons of carbon dioxide doesn't mean much to you, would it at least show you the emission factors for food scraps? And these are the emission factors for landfills. And these are the options we offer you currently in WARM. We offer you the national average, which is the average of those that have capture and those that don't. So it comes out to be about a capture rate of 44%. Landfills that have no recovery, landfills that flare, landfills that do recover, and right now our current default is 75%. And as you can see, with no recovery, there's significantly more carbon dioxide release, not surprisingly, than in the recovery system. And then the last line is the actual emissions for composting, and you'll see there's a negative in front of those because there's actually a net benefit to composting, because what we're saying is when you compost, there's 0.2 metric tons of carbon dioxide less than there would be if not. And the benefits are actually the combination of this minus 0.2 plus whatever option you choose above. So say we did national average. So if you composted a ton of food scraps and you assume the national average landfill, your benefit would be a negative, I can do math quickly, 0.91 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So this is just to kind of give you an idea of the sort of numbers. Probably it doesn't even have necessarily a lot of resonance for me, and I look at these numbers all the time. To give you some maybe some context, though, the greenhouse gases for a for grass in a no recovery landfill is 0.51. So you can see the food scraps and the grasses are fairly putrescible. The landfill no recovery for food scraps is much higher. So food scraps is definitely the high value here. Okay, I can't believe I have a voice left. Just kind of an FYI, because a lot of times when you're managing food scraps, you'll be managing other organic waste along with those food scraps. And in WARM, we include yard waste. We also have grass, leaves, branches, and mixed organics, which is currently based on the number, the weights of organics that we find in our EPA characterization report. I think it's 52% yard waste, 48% food waste. May have that backwards. Apologize if I do. And paper products are also, as we all know, an organic waste and often managed in compost piles, but we don't currently have them as a composting option. Not sure if we're going to do that in the future. I wouldn't be surprised if we do. But currently, there's no composting option for paper products, even the soil paper products that may go along with the food waste. So just a little quick hit on the model here, just to show you. And hopefully, if you haven't seen it before, you'll see it here and you'll say, oh, it looks pretty easy, because it's really not bad once you get into it. This is the jump page, one of the first pages you'll find. The website right now is fairly easy. It's www.epa.gov/warm, W-A-R-M. And you can choose either the online version or the Excel version. I recommend the online version for a quick little analysis. The Excel version if you're going to do a more complete analysis, because you can't save the online version and you really don't want to go in and enter in 20 different categories and then have to re-enter. So the Excel version is really better for a more intensive look. In the future, it's also possible, I think, the Excel version is going to contain a lot more of the complex options, and the online version is going to stay a lot more scaled down. Kind of as we get a lot more users, it's kind of good to keep a simpler version and then more complex. So a lot of the changes I was talking about earlier, probably in the future, are only going to be available on the Excel version. So this is what you're going to see when you open the model. And those of you who haven't looked in a while and knew it before, it used to be the two options were on top and bottom of each other, and we now have what we're calling a side-by-side format. We're hoping this is a lot easier to use, because instead of having to scroll down and enter numbers, in the alternative scenario, you can see right across the screen. And I'm going to go, it's going to cut out the header. I show you here as you scroll down to get to food scraps, which is maybe about two-thirds way down the page here. You'll see that in the first scenario, I entered that I was going to landfill 10 tons of food scraps. And then the tons generated column actually fills in itself. And then in the alternative scenario, I say in the alternative, I'm going to compost 10 tons. You could alternately, if you wanted to, say you were going to compost 5 tons and landfill 5 tons in the future, or in the baseline, as long as they still equal whatever that tons generated in the middle is. So this is hopefully a more clear way to look at the baseline and the alternate scenario for the materials. I put 10 tons here. Another good rule of thumb is that for most materials, WARM doesn't function well under a ton or so. If you do have less than that, call me and we have some kind of mathematical tricks we can use to put those numbers in. But it really does require more than a ton of material or so to show you significant results and significant digits. And that's basically because it is measuring rather large processes, and it's not measuring really kind of small things. We're talking about manufacturing and mining, so pretty big things here. and you'll see the other organic materials. You'll also see that for food scraps, there's no recycled option. We basically consider composting the recycled option. And we just recently added the source reduction option. At this time, all that's going to do is basically give you a zero for the source reduction, saying there's no emissions from source reduction. In a perfect world, I would be able to figure out all the emissions from the non-production of all these food products if we source reduce, but it's really much too comprehensive an undertaking, and so we've instead put a zero there so people can at least show some benefit from source reducing food. And I think I'm almost done here. So this is then the report you'll get, the results report. And what it'll show you is the emissions from the baseline. And if you remember back, you'll remember that the landfilling had a positive number. And so you'll see the positive 7 here. And then the, and I used the default options, I should say. And then you'll see the emissions from the alternative management scenario, which is composting in our case. And again, that had a negative, so we have a negative here. And then in the big box, you can kind of see how they all line up. And so our net benefit from composting 10 tons of food waste is negative 9 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. So I think that's the end. And again, my great apologies for my somewhat stunted voice here and my inability to get through more of this material. But I'd be more than happy to also talk to anyone one-on-one if they're interested in learning more about how to run the model, and maybe the assumptions in the model, or even discussing some of the changes we're thinking about making in the future here, and getting more information, because I think it's going to be a really exciting amount of changes for the food waste. And it's going to be one of the biggest departures we've really made from the original model since it was first put in place in, I guess, 1998 or so. So it should be really interesting, and food waste is really going to benefit the most from a lot of the changes. We'll see. So I think that's it. Thanks for bearing with me, and I guess I'll take questions at the end.
All right. Thanks, Jen. This is Amy again, and so now we're ready for the question and answer period to begin. As mentioned, and as some of you already know, there's the question and answer module that's up, a feature that's at the top of your screen next to voice and video. If you type in your question in the box and click the Ask button, you'll be able to ask a question, and then I'll read your question out loud. If you happen to know that you'd like to direct your question to Jen or Priscilla, please note that in your question. And any of the questions that we don't have time to answer today will be compiled and answered via email in the following weeks.
So Amy, I must have run over on my presentation because I actually still have the waste audit presentation I haven't done. How do you want to handle it?
Oh, you do. Okay. That's right. I'm sorry. Go ahead and please continue.
Well, this is Gary Funlin. Before we do that, we do only have about 15 minutes left for questions, and we won't have time to answer questions online by voice if, in fact, we do Priscilla's presentation.
Okay.
So what are you thinking?
I think it would probably be easier to answer some of these questions out loud or in person, because they look a little bit complicated.
Okay, then let's do that. If there's any time at the end for a quick presentation on waste audits by Priscilla, we'll do that. Otherwise, we'll try to figure out a way that she could squeeze in one of the other webinars.
Sure, that sounds like a very good idea. Let's start with some questions. Priscilla, there's one for you that says, you said that residual food waste requires pickup at least twice per week. Are there any municipalities doing pickups that frequently? Most that they are aware of pick up weekly.
We don't have any in New Jersey that are actually picking up at all. When I use the twice speak, I'm basing it more on the commercial side, which in New Jersey, essentially, I think most of the haulers try to pick up at least 3 times a week. Most of the commercial generators don't like to have their food waste sitting around any longer than that. And the only town I can think of right now is, I mean, it's obviously San Francisco. I don't know how often they pick up the food waste. It may be just 1 week out there. But again, I was basing it on the commercial side because that's mostly what we've looked at. And that, again, is they like to have it every 2 or 3 days. And so that ends up being either 2 or 3 times a week.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm out here in San Francisco right now, and they pick up the food waste 1 week. Priscilla, this is another question for you. I'm trying to give Jen's voice a little bit of a rest. Why no, Morgan's question is, why no more outdoor uncovered composting facilities? Why aren't they allowed in New Jersey? More outdoor uncovered composting facilities?
Well, we have a very restrictive regulatory structure here, I think. We also have more people per square inch than any other state. And in New Jersey, we have a lot of NIMBYs, I guess. But the other thing is that we had one facility that was for at least a period of time. It was one of the largest in the country, perhaps the largest in the country, and it had new owners. They weren't managing it well. They had a serious odor problem, and essentially that's just our feeling that it's not going to happen again in New Jersey because of that particular problem. And as I said, as a result, we're looking towards the facilities that either have the covered windrows or the in-vessel solutions.
Okay. Another question that's more based on the New York City metro area, but what would waste pickup look like in a residential area such as the New York City metro area, and would residents be given containers like in San Francisco, or would food scraps be bagged? The question for you, Priscilla.
Well, I don't know exactly, but one of the things one of the reasons why we find, as I said, we're working in the ironbound section of Newark. The ironbound section of Newark is a predominantly ethnic area and also one where there's a lot of restaurants. But additionally, it's like New York in that you have a lot of residential, too. And so that's an exciting area to us because we're hoping that there would be some kind of joint collection system. You know, the thing is that the kind of collection system I would like to see would be something more like the shared sheds of Northampton, something like that, because on the whole, we've got a lot of small restaurants, homes, whatever, and so if we could share the collection that way, that would be good. But I mean, I don't know exactly what would happen in New York. I know there are some restaurants that just collect, you know, are hauled by action carting, and I don't know exactly how they handle it. But the residential, I think, might have to be some kind of shared kind of thing, or just once a week, like in San Francisco.
Priscilla, this is Gary Feinland. One of our speakers in one of the webinars we'll be having a little bit later, Peter Anderson, was the principal author on Beyond Recycling, which is a new report that they put out this year. And it talks specifically about residential waste pickup and all the different kinds of options available. So hopefully he could shed some light on that in a few weeks.
Great. Jennifer, I'd like to address some of the questions that relate to the WARM model.
Okay.
One of them is, does EPA have any estimates comparing landfill diversion carbon savings from anaerobic digestion versus composting?
No, we don't, but we actually are thinking about, and that's another improvement we're thinking about making in the next year or so, is incorporating anaerobic digestion as a waste management option. The consulting firm that ICF helps us with our modeling actually included it in Canada, and so they have some estimates, and we would like to look at that and possibly include it as a option in future versions of the model in addition to composting. It would be anaerobic digestion.
And as a clarification, one of the questions is food waste included in the WARM model, and your answer is that it
yes.
is? Right, okay. Another one to move along is, does the WARM model use local emission factors for a site-specific analysis, or does it use a national average?
We use national averages for the model, with the exception of the landfill. The landfill is where you could specify different capture rates, or in the future we're going to have different conditions, probably wet, dry. But for most other things, we assume that there's a national average emission factor. And for a lot of things, it's really out of necessity because most things aren't managed locally. Food scraps tends to be one of the only things that is, but you can change the landfilling options.
Okay. Another question relating to the model is, how does composting generate, how does one generate negative M metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent from composting?
Yeah, that's kind of the negative number is always kind of a brain
right.
teaser for people. For composting, part of it is carbon storage. So what you're saying is there's carbon that is being removed from the atmosphere that otherwise would have been released. So that's a negative number. The most conventional use of the negative number you'll see in a lot of the other materials, and what that is processes that don't have to happen. So it would have had to have been mined, and because it isn't mined, you get negative all those mining emissions. So basically that's where negatives come from, are avoided practices that you don't have to do. There aren't as many with composting. We are looking into a possible offset value for not having to produce fertilizer, another thing we're working on. And if that happens, there might be a negative from the production process, all the emissions avoided in the production process of fertilizer for making compost. But that's basically where the negative number comes from. It's more avoided emissions.
Okay. The next question is for either of the presenters. So Jen or Priscilla, do either of you have information regarding handling food waste packaging, removing the package, so i.e. removing the packaging to process organic separately, the processes used, and the possible firms processing these types of waste? And if I'm not clear, I can repeat the question.
Processing the packaging waste?
Right. So the fact that organics tend to come with packaging, are there firms out there that, and what are the processes that they use to separate the organics from the packaging and process those separately?
In New Jersey, at certain supermarkets, at the end of the day, if the employees get time, they're encouraged to depackage the things like that may be in plastic or something like that. And I know Jennifer McDonald developed sort of a 5-second rule, I think it is. I forget how many seconds it is, but it was sort of, you know, if it's easy to depackage it and if they have the time, they're encouraged to do that. Willenta, which is a feed firm in, well, it's a pig feeding firm in New Jersey, actually has a depackaging facility which uses mechanical depackaging. I have not seen the facility. It's in Woodbridge, and I'm planning it over there. But so I don't know. Neither of those, however, is going to recover the packaging. In most instances, the kind of packaging that's recyclable is not things that have been against food waste. at least plastic against food waste. Like, for instance, at the Whole Earth Center where we just did a waste audit, the packaging we'd be looking at, recycling, that was around food would be just sort of the shrink wrap around the outer containers, the cases or whatever, things that aren't contaminated with food. So I'm not so sure there's a way of, at the current time of recycling packaging that you remove from the food that's right against the food itself.
Yeah, and I think Priscilla's right that most of that really does have to happen at the source of the waste, and there's a lot of composters that if you tend to send them a lot of packaging and a lot of contamination, they're maybe not going to work with you anymore. So it's really, in most situations, the responsibility of the person putting out their waste to make it as clean as possible when it is picked up to go to the compost operation.
Okay.
Well, I'd like to add that the new Delaware compost facility has been able to find a market for their plastics, and I can't recall the name of the group, but we can get something out when we answer some of the questions by email.
Peninsula?
Yeah, the Peninsula group, thank you very much. They found a market for their plastics, so as they do the composting and the screening process at the end, then they can actually separate the plastics, bale them, and they have a market for recycling those materials.
Okay, we have just a couple more questions that hopefully we can get answered. So, Jen, this one's for you. Can you remind us of the methane CO2 equivalent factor used for worm?
I was afraid someone was going to ask that. I can't remember if it's 21 or 23, and I was trying to look which one we have currently. And I'm sorry, I'm not really sure, because I think it's still 21, because the IPCC has started using a 23, but I think we're still reporting with the 21. But it's somewhere there. I'm really apologize for not having that exactly. It's not 72.
Okay. Another question is, has there been a price premium put on these avoided emissions?
I guess, is that referring to carbon markets and such, I guess, maybe?
I believe so.
I know people are working on it. I know the Climate Action Reserve Registry, folks out in California, are working on a compost protocol right now. The Chicago Climate Exchange does have a compost protocol, and so there are developing markets for these emissions. They're not using the WARM model per se to use, and we don't necessarily want them to, because part of the problem is figuring out, because it is a life cycle and many parties are involved, what portion of the emissions to give credit for. But I do know that the two major climate registries and the climate inventories are working on giving compost credit. And I know the CAR one, they're just working on it now, and it's in an active process.
Okay. And then the last question that we have in the log is for you, Priscilla. It's, do waste auditors need to be certified, and if so, where can they gain certification?
There's not a certification system that I'm aware of for waste auditors. In New Jersey, I think everybody's pretty much self-trained. I mentioned four, New York, New Jersey, and we have a certification system. We haven't done auditors yet. We've done generators, and we've started looking at other things like facilities and haulers, but we haven't done auditors. I don't know of any system for that yet. We'd be happy to develop one, I guess.
Okay, I think that answers all the questions. Gary, did you want to take over?
Sure, thanks, Amy. I just wanted to thank everyone for participating in today's webinar of our overview of food waste, and thank you to Jennifer Brady and Priscilla Hayes for presenting. Your information was very helpful. please email any questions that were not submitted in the Q&A feature to Shane Nelson. That's nelson.shane@epamail.gov. A list of the questions and responses will be sent to all participants by email. And an evaluation form for today's webinar will be emailed to participants as well. We really welcome your feedback. Our next session in the five-part series is separation and collection of food waste. It's going to happen on March 10th, and we hope that you'll join us then. Thank you.